Hoop Dreams from Here to Seoul, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. South Korea's pro basketball league comes to Las Vegas to draft American talent, but a player told this reporter that life in Korea is not what you think.
Everyone thinks that international basketball is this glamorous life in Italy with sports cars, and in reality, he says, I'm sitting in this tiny little cold apartment in Korea watching Facebook fall down like the Matrix.
Plus, growing up gut shayer in New York meant a lot of dough rolling.
Because it has to be thin, and the saying is that you should be able to read a newspaper through it. So my grandfather would follow me around saying, I can't read a newspaper through it.
And seagulls terrorized the British coast.
They were swarming around me, Marco. I could have been in real trouble.
That's coming up today on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Good to be back with you after a couple of weeks off. Hard to totally unplug from the news, though, even on vacation, especially that story last week of young Turkish activists planning to go to Syria to help rebuild. Youthful optimism cut short by a suicide bombing. Tragic. And that's where we start things off today, with the reaction to last week's violence in Turkey. Many believe, including Turkey's government, that that violence was the work of ISIS. And this weekend, Turkey and the U.S. agreed to work together to push ISIS out from at least part of northern Syria. Mehmet Ali Tugtan is a professor at Istanbul Bilgi University. He tells me this is part of a larger shift by the Turkish government in Ankara.
Up to this point, Turkey was reluctant to extend its cooperation with the United States to include the enormous NATO base in Incirlik, Adana. But now Turkey not only allowed NATO use of the facility, but also it opened the facility to predetermined allied aircraft from regional allies, like Jordan, for example. It also allowed drone flights in addition to standard conventional fighter jets, which is a huge deal.
I mean, the U.S. has also been reluctant to go into the Syrian war. Is this the intervention from the West that everyone's been waiting for?
It's not, because since the beginning of the civil war in Syria, the expectation, at least on the part of Turkey and regional allies like Qatar, Saudi Arabia, was a military invasion quite along the lines of the Libyan intervention back in 2011. But that was not forthcoming, mainly due to Russian and Chinese objections in the United Nations Security Council. And those objections stand. And so the expected intervention is not forthcoming, but the allies have been doing what they can under the circumstances.
Yeah, but it is a kind of intervention, isn't it?
Yes, of course. But airstrikes over Syria and Iraq have been going on for 10 months now. They started last September, and they largely concentrated in the border town of Kobani, or Ain al-Arab, as the official Syrian name goes, to save the beleaguered Kurdish enclave there. And since it had been saved from Islamic State siege about 2-3 months ago, the allies have been still bombing different targets around Syria, most notably in Raqqa, the stronghold of the Islamic State.
Right, but in the last 72 hours, those airstrikes are way up, right?
In the last 72 hours, what happened is the Incirlik base came online. If you're flying in Adana, in southern Turkey. You see, geographically, if you're flying in from the Persian Gulf, from off the shores of Kuwait, as the Americans are doing right now, you only have a few hours of operational radius over northern Syria, and then you have to head back to refuel. But if you're flying in from Incirlik, you have several hours of operational radius. So that's a huge advantage.
Right. Now, this is not a neat strategy. You can just kind of wind up and let it do its thing. Turkish Air Force is also bombing Kurdish militias in these airstrikes. So can you tell us what that means for the war in Syria?
You see, Turkey has been reluctant to aid the coalition airstrikes and open Incirlik, largely because not that they didn't like the Islamic State. Turkey declared the Islamic State as a terrorist organization from the beginning. But Turkey had been sort of instrumentalizing the Islamic State against Bashar al-Assad's regime in Syria, along with other regional allies like Qatar. And secondly, the losses of the Islamic State in northern Syria translate to gains of the Kurdish militia in northern Syria, who are, for practical purposes, an extension of the terrorist organization PKK, which is the Kurdish separatist organization inside Turkey. So the Turkish government wanted sort of a balance. If the Islamic State is going to be dispersed with, then it should not be replaced by PKK or its extensions in Syria. And the Americans didn't so much as approved this strategy, but they just turn a blind eye for the time being. It's not like the Americans have approved Turkish strikes against PKK or YPG targets in Syria, but for the time being, they are tolerating it for continuing Turkish cooperation against the Islamic State.
Mehmet Ali Tugtan there, a professor at Istanbul Bilgi University. The Turkish decision to strike Kurdish targets complicates matters for the U.S. The Kurds have been America's best ally in the region, both during the long war in Iraq and now in the fight against the so-called Islamic State. So how's all this going down with the Kurds? That's a question I put to the world's old friend Ayub Nouri. He's the English editor of the Kurdish news service Rudau, and he used to work for the World in Iraq.
The Kurdish community all over the world, in the Middle East, in Europe or North America, they are not happy at all. And they say that Turkey should appreciate the brave fight that the PKK and its branches inside Syria are conducting against ISIS instead of bombing the PKK. So the Kurds are not happy, and they are equally unhappy with Washington. They believe that Washington has given Turkey the green light to go ahead and bomb the Kurdish bases in northern Iraq.
Yeah, so what's your audience and the readers of Rudau saying about the U.S. role in this, making this deal with Turkey right now?
Well, our readers are equally divided. Half of them are blaming the PKK. They say that another conflict is the last thing the Kurdish people need in the Middle East, and the PKK should continue its peace talks with Turkey. And that's exactly what also the Kurdish president of the Kurdistan region said yesterday. He said, you can never achieve anything except through peace and dialogue. And half of our readers or people who check our website for that particular subject, they blame the U.S. and they blame Turkey. They feel that the U.S. has once again betrayed the Kurds. So it's very complicated, and there is a lot of blame going around right now.
Well, yeah, and some passionate and emotional opinions that have been posted at Rudau that you've had to moderate and even delete. I'm wondering if you could give us an example or two of the kinds of things that are in people's minds.
Some of them say that never trust the USA, even though US is pretending or saying they are fighting ISIS. Finally, they have come around to work with Turkey to attack the Kurds and abandon the Kurds, who are the only effective fighting force against ISIS. And others say, no, Turkey has always wanted to do this. And in fact, they are not dropping any bombs on ISIS. It's just fake airstrikes, but the real airstrikes are directed against the PKK. And some readers are calling for uprising or even arms insurrection in Turkey against Turkey, and others call for peace.
I mean, you're the editor on the English side of this website. Do you think their anger is justifiable?
I think, yes, the anger is justifiable in the sense that the world was very happy that in the Middle East mayhem or mess, there was one stable region, which was the Kurdish region of northern Iraq and the other Kurdish region of Syria and Turkey. In that sense, people are justified in their anger that this is the last thing we really want. And also they are unhappy that PKK, that's effective fighting force against ISIS in Syria, is attacked by Turkey. But I hope it will end really soon, because if the fighting spills over from Syria into Turkey, it will take many more years to subside.
Ayub Nouri worked for us here at The World in Iraq during the war there and is now editor of the Kurdish news service Rudau in Toronto. Ayub, thank you as always.
Thank you very much.
Last week, aspiring basketball players joined dozens of managers, coaches, and scouts in Las Vegas. After 4 days of tryouts, these athletes were hoping to be drafted to play in a professional basketball league. But this was not for the NBA. This was the draft for the Korean Basketball League. Les Carpenter, who writes about sports for The Guardian, witnessed this draft process, and he's going to tell us all about it. So there's a Korean Basketball League. I mean, how popular is a sport in South Korea?
It's a good question. It is the number one popular sport in the winter, probably the third behind soccer and baseball. But it's becoming very popular, and basketball is such an international game anyway. I think the league has existed since 1997.
Now, this draft process, I gather, has been happening in Las Vegas for a while now for the Korean League, right?
Yeah, they started a couple other places, Philadelphia, Los Angeles, but eventually at some point moved it to Las Vegas. The reason for that is the NBA plays its summer league in Las Vegas, and so they kind of siphon off some players from that. You also happen to have just a group of scouts around. There's a lot of basketball going on in Las Vegas this time of year. So it logistically made a lot of sense. However, it just kind of adds to the intrigue and the exotic nature of the Korean Basketball League having its tryouts and drafts in Las Vegas.
Yeah, crazy. So where does this all happen in Las Vegas? I mean, they're having tryouts, so they need some courts, and then there is some draft process ceremony, right?
So it's a 4-day process. There's a kind of a weigh-in and measurement the first day. The next 2 days, they have a tryout. It's a series of games played at a high school. And then on the last day, they have a draft. And this year, they held it at the Palms Casino in a ballroom. So you kind of walk by all these baccarat tables and, you know, slot machines and all this, you know, bells and dinging. And then you go into this conference room and you walk into just another world. It's this draft for the Korean Basketball League.
You know, my sense of any foreign league is that they draw American players who are not good enough for the NBA. Is there any overarching reason you can give why these players choose the Korean League?
Well, the very biggest reason is that it pays really well. Basically, the draft is only for essentially American players. There's 10 teams and it's a 2-round draft. In the Korean League, they have 2 slots that are designated for foreigners. Everyone else is a Korean player. The players that come to this are coming because they're either going to make $30,000 a month as a first rounder or $20,000 a month as a second rounder. And while you can make money like that in other countries, or maybe even a little bit more at times, the Korean League teams are very stable. So everyone is comfortable with the fact that you're actually going to get paid.
Your article describes some of the magnificent egos among some of these players. Tell us about somebody you met.
Oh my gosh, there's so many. Well, here's one. He does not have an ego at all, but he was a wonderful story. Chris Massey, who had never played basketball in high school. And one day a friend said, "Why don't you come play in this basketball game downtown?" There were several professional players there, and they saw him and they recommended him. Next thing you know, he's going off to college. And after his college career, he embarked on a very long pro career. He's now in his late 30s, and he's played in Korea for a couple of years.
You also describe in your article some of the limits on who the Korean League can draft. Tell us about those limits.
Actually, up until this year, the Korean League was essentially only coming here to look for big men, anyone basically over about 6'7", since your average Korean basketball player is probably going to be somewhat shorter than that. This year, I think they felt that the Korean League just wasn't flashy enough, that wasn't fast enough. The bigger American players were kind of slowing the game down. So this year, you have to draft a player under 6'4", or 6'4" and under, and then you can draft a big man.
Did you speak with any veteran American players who spoke about the culture shock they felt when they got to play in Korea? I suppose some of the culture shock starts right in the casino.
Well, the whole thing, I mean, just sitting through that draft, I think, was a culture shock. Just the idea of the draft lottery was a culture shock for guys. But yeah, I did. And one in particular, Rob Benson, who played at University of California, was fantastic about it. And he said that, you know, in Korea, the coaches are going to ask everything of you. So he's 6'8". They're going to ask him to guard somebody about half his size, while at the same time guard somebody who's as big as him, while at the same time getting as many rebounds as he can, while at the same time trying to score. It's all impossible.
Right.
And he says that you have to, as a player, as an American, go over there and realize that they're going to ask their American players to do the impossible, and you have to try to just grin and say okay and do your best.
Les Carpenter writes about sports for The Guardian. Les, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Still to come, drug cartel kingpin El Chapo didn't just escape from jail. He fled via a super tunnel. We'll explain why they're super later here on The World. So who wants to spend some quality time this summer on top of a glacier in Greenland? Reporter Ari Daniel, that's who. He's on assignment in Greenland this week for The World and our partners at the PBS program Nova. Hello, Ari Daniel again.
Hello, Marco Werman.
So I know you're on a glacier somewhere in Greenland, Ari. That's a big country and island, though. Where exactly are you in Greenland?
I'm in the southeast on the rocky margin next to the second largest glacier in the country called Helheim Glacier. The scale of it is a little hard to comprehend. I actually just, like, 15 minutes ago stepped out off of a helicopter ride. So we got to fly down next to the glacier itself and see just how incredible it is. It's a 4-mile-wide canyon that is filled with snow and ice. And it just goes off as far as the eye can see. And then right in front of me is this 30-story high snow cliff. And that marks the boundary between the end of the glacier and the beginning of where it starts to calve into the sea.
So, Ari, we know Greenland is melting pretty darn fast. What is it about this particular glacier, the Helheim Glacier, that the researchers you're with are interested in?
So, as I look across the glacier now, there's something they call the bathtub ring. That was the glacier height back in the early 2000s, meaning that there was a kind of massive melting event within the last 10 years. And so that's why the scientists are here, to figure out what's happening. And of course, if there is this massive loss of ice at the glacier, that ice is going to empty out into the sea.
So Ari, make this real for me. I just came back from 2 weeks on Cape Cod, where the ocean water was the warmest I've ever felt it. Connect that to what you've been seeing in Greenland.
We see that certain parts of the ocean, the temperature is rising. In particular, we're seeing warmer water in the north that's kind of entering the fjords and starts kind of touching and tickling the glaciers. That could lead to more melting. And we could see sea level rise as a result of glaciers like this one melting more rapidly.
Yeah, what you're saying is kind of disturbing, Ari. Warmer seas cause more melting, which causes more warming. It's kind of a feedback loop, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't mean to make it sound so scary.
So, Ari, we're going to hear a lot more about the details of what's going on there when you get back. But just tell me, what's life like there for you and the scientists? Is it just like one long day of getting in and out of helicopters and sensing the melt?
I will say it's one long day because there is really no darkness at this time of year. Last night we went on a night hike, and a night hike is a bit of a misnomer. And so we hiked up over the pass, and the Greenland ice sheet was just a couple miles away. So I was looking at that ice sheet, and it's just spectacular.
Mm. The World's Ari Daniel on the Helheim Glacier in southern Greenland. Ari is reporting from Greenland, is supported by the Pulitzer Center for Crisis Reporting and our partners at NOVA here at WGBH in Boston. What's it like to be from a place that no longer exists? Well, you can ask the Gotscheers. They come from the small European city of Gotsche, but that city is gone now, and its people are scattered. A small pocket of Gotscheers lives in New York, and that's where reporter Daniel Gross found them.
Bobby Thomason is a third-generation Gotscheer. She was even Miss Gotsche 2005. But as a kid, she didn't know what Gotsche was.
There was a whole slew of names that were used to explain where my grandparents came from. Gotsche was absolutely used, but so was the Habsburg Empire and Austria-Hungary. And so it was really quite confusing to me.
The city of Gotsche started as a colony of Austrians in the 1300s. In what's now Slovenia. It was a German-speaking linguistic island, surrounded by a sea of Slavic speakers. Because it was mostly independent, unique Gotscheer recipes and sayings developed. Before Bobby understood any of this, she just knew a few Gotscheer traditions, like the Gotscheer version of apple strudel.
I would make this with my grandmother, and it requires her pulling out the whole dining room table to roll the dough, because it has to be thin. And the saying is that you should be able to read a newspaper through it. So my grandfather would follow me around saying, I can't read a newspaper through it.
When Bobby was a teenager, she visited what had been her grandmother's hometown, a village near what used to be Gotsche. There wasn't much there.
In the house that she had grown up in, there were, you know, trees coming through the floorboards, and the town was essentially a dirt road of about 6 houses, and most of them were abandoned.
Still, that visit fascinated Bobby. she started asking questions and learned that World War II changed everything for the Gottschalkers. At the time, Gottschalkers lived an isolated life. But Hitler expected all German speakers to join the Reich. The Gottschalkers were resettled in German-controlled territory. Some supported Nazi Germany. Others felt they didn't have a choice. Here's how Bobby's grandmother, Helen Meisel, described it to her.
I was 11 years old when we left Gottschalk. Hitler resettled us. But then when Hitler lost the war, the Germans lost the war, we also lost our home. We were homeless. We were refugees.
They couldn't go home because Gottschalk had been taken over by Yugoslavia, which didn't want them there. One of the largest groups of Gottschalkers moved to New York. During the war, they had briefly become Germans, yet they ended up becoming Americans. Bobby began interviewing older Gottschalkers for what later became a book.
Well, I went to school in Austria. They called us Ausländer, foreigners. We came in 1950 to the United States. And then I went to school over here, and they called me Nazi.
I was born in Gottschalk in 1935. We came by boat, by ship, but we were able to see New York City already, and our big impression was the higher buildings and the many, many cars. It was like another world, which another world opened up, yes.
Today, Gottschalk descendants keep up some traditions at an annual folk festival in New York. At this year's event, Bobby marched in a procession of former Miss Gottschalks. Some older people still sing Gottschalk songs in a local choir. Others, like Albert and Resi Beli, speak the dialect among themselves.
You want a sample or what? Why are you asking? Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose, yes.
Müsste hun Bibel Gottschalkerisch reden.
Ja, wo schon.
Oh, von Pichl, von deinem Dorf.
Wir können auch noch Gottschalkerisch singen, ne?
Ja, no, das können aber ein neues Duett mehr machen. She said we could still sing the Gottschalk songs, but they don't sound so nice anymore. Our voices are a little rusty at that age, you know.
I think the Gottschalkers are absolutely an extreme case of the American dream. What's really unique about the Gottschalkers is the fact that the homeland that they had doesn't exist anymore. It remains, I think, a very fragile future as far as what is going to exist of the Gottschalkers in 50 or 100 years, because so many of them really are becoming American.
Bobby knows Gottschalk culture may be slipping away. On the other hand, these Gottschalkers, after centuries of not fitting into their surroundings, may have finally found a home. For The World, I'm Daniel Gross in New York.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. When it comes to underground smuggling in Mexico, there are tunnels, and then there are super tunnels.
They're usually between 30 and 70 feet below ground. They have electric lighting, they have ventilation, and they also have rails.
Yes, to move goods by electric cart. That story's coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 15,000 skills like networking, nutrition, and ninja training. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at curious.com/PRI.
I'm Marco Werman, and it's The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Haitian immigrants in the Dominican Republic are still not quite sure where they stand. A deadline passed last month for them and their Dominican-born children to apply for legal status in the Dominican Republic or risk deportation, but so far, no mass deportations. The Haitian and Dominican governments say those Haitians who have left have mostly self-deported on a voluntary basis. But that's not what reporter Bridget Huber heard when she spoke to some of those who have left.
André Joseph was born in Haiti, but he spent almost his entire life in the Dominican Republic. He's undocumented, though. About a month ago, he returned to Haiti for the first time in some 40 years, and not by choice. He says about 48 hours before the deadline to apply for permanent residency, a group of Dominican men came to his house with guns, hammers, and sticks.
The men were going to kill me, he says. I was with my wife and son, and we ran. We left our house and all our possessions. Our lives are more important than the things we own. The family hid in a field all night and went to the police station in the morning. But Josef says the authorities didn't want to hear about the anti-immigrant mob.
No.
He says they told him, Haitian devil, go back to your country. This is not your country. The police locked them up, then put them in a truck and took them to the border along with about 25 others. Now they're stranded at a school on the Haitian side. About 50 people are staying in the school. Bedding's piled up along the walls and on top of desks. Some young women are braiding each other's hair, while others are cooking beans over an open fire on the ground outdoors. Natacha Dona is sitting outside the school.
Yo tengo mucho tiempo, Santo Domingo.
Her parents brought her to the Dominican Republic when she was 8. That was 33 years ago. She's here with her 4 sons, all Dominican-born. That's Kevin's, her youngest. Dona's 5 months pregnant, and she's been sick for a while. When police came to her house a couple of weeks ago, she thought they might help her get to the hospital. She says, they didn't even give me time to grab clothes or my kids' papers. Nothing. I ended up here. Everyone I talk to at the school tells a similar story. Dona said she thinks she has some relatives in the north of Haiti, but she doesn't know how to find them. The father of her kids is Dominican, and even though the couple separated, he was still helping provide for them. Dona doesn't know how she'll take care of them in Haiti. The border checkpoint is a few miles away from the school. It has the inauspicious name of Mal Pass, bad crossing. I didn't see any Haitians being deported there, just lots of bored-looking street vendors and motorcycle taxi drivers waiting around for a customer. One driver named Luis Rigoberto Piña Volquez tells me his country is getting a bad rap in the international press. He wants me to convey a message to New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, who has described the deportations as illegal, immoral, and racist. He says, de Blasio is saying the Dominican Republic is mistreating the immigrants. Then why doesn't the mayor of New York ask for 10,000 of them to be sent over there, to the U.S.? The Haitian government pledged to build a welcome center for deportees near the border. But I went to the site and there was nothing there, just a big empty lot with a sign reading, Welcome Center for Repatriated People. One aid worker told me people who leave the school get about $20 from the government, but not much else. André Joseph says one of the worst things about being at the school is having nothing to do. He used to wake up at dawn and work in the fields until dark. Now he just sits around and waits. He says the Dominicans have profited from years of Haitian labor, and now they're casting them aside. He says, we Haitians are really the Dominican slaves. We've made them rich. Asked whether he considers himself Haitian or Dominican, Josef says recent events have left little doubt. I'm Haitian, he says. If I was Dominican, they wouldn't have expelled me like some dog. For The World, I'm Bridget Huber, Malpass, Haiti.
As we just heard, this is a contentious issue in Haiti, and it's also sparked a big debate here in Boston. Ask Dennis Benzin. Benzin is the vice mayor of my city of Cambridge, just across the river from Boston. In recent weeks, he and a number of other members of Boston's Dominican community, including Pulitzer Prize-winning author Juno Diaz, have been called traitors against their country. That's because they've criticized the Dominican Republic's citizenship policies toward people of Haitian descent. The vice mayor joins me now. Mr. Benzin, thanks for joining us. First of all, what is your connection to the Dominican Republic?
First of all, thank you for having me, Marco. My connection to the Dominican Republic is that my father is of Dominican descent, and I was born in the city of Cambridge, but I spent the first few years of my life in the Dominican Republic being treated for asthma. I had a late uncle of the Dominican Republic who was an army general and the chief medical doctor for the army. And I spent quite a bit of time in his household as a young child, and I've traveled frequently to the Dominican Republic. You know, I love the Dominican Republic, and this is one of the issues that really pains me quite a bit.
Why does it pain you? Why have you chosen to speak out against this policy?
The issue of race and the issue of immigration is inextricably linked to the legacy of slavery in the Dominican Republic and on the island of Hispaniola. You know, it pains me because there's been a silence around what has been happening in the Dominican Republic. And it's not just as a result of La Sentencia, which was the law in 2013 that was passed by the Constitutional Court denationalizing Haitians, but it's also, you know, the history of race on the island. And, you know, the fact that there are several members of our community that have that stood up against what they see as a violation of human rights in the Dominican Republic, and they've been, you know, vilified. And, you know, in many ways, it's shameful because Dominicans come to the United States to be protected by some of the greatest laws in the world. You know, it's a hypocrisy for and very hypocritical of us to go back to the island and expect to treat others differently.
You know, some local leaders in the Boston community have said that this racism does not exist. What would you say to them?
Issues of race are always difficult to talk about. And, you know, where we need to start as a community is acknowledging our history of racial discrimination on the island. I mean, I've been the victim of discrimination on several occasions in the Dominican Republic. In 2004, we were discriminated against at a lounge/nightclub. And we were not allowed to gain entrance because we were told that we had limitations in society and we were told that we were Black. I ended up extending my trip so that I could talk about the issue and talk about the experience and what it meant to me, but also to retain an attorney. We filed suit under international human rights law because the Dominican Republic does not have laws that prevent discrimination or provide recourse for anyone that has been discriminated. And till this day, I'm waiting for a hearing. This conversation should not really be about anyone's right to express their opinions about what's happening in the DR. It should really be about how do we make the Dominican Republic a better democracy.
You know, I was at a school graduation recently in Cambridge, and one of the teachers of Haitian descent put to the assembled students to be aware of what is being done by Dominicans to Haitians down in the Dominican Republic. I'm just curious, how have you seen this debate spread into the wider community of Haitians and Dominicans here?
You know, I have a group of 12 interns that are working with me this summer from high school, and many of them are Dominican and Haitian. And they're doing their own research, and they're talking about this issue openly. It's a healthy conversation for us to have. You know, we've got to ask ourselves, you know, what kind of society do we want to have? And what are the laws that we want to put in place that protect human rights, but that also give any member of society legal recourse in the event that they are discriminated against? You know, I can give you a perfect example. About 5 years ago, I was at a concert, and a great bachata singer by the name of Anthony Santos invited me onto the stage. There were thousands of people in the audience. He says, you know, vote for Dennis Benzin if you do not want to be treated like a Haitian.
Wow.
And so if you take that statement alone, it implies issues around race. It implies that Dominican society in many ways looks down at Haitian people. You know, what's great and what I love about America and what I love about having grown up in Cambridge is that, you know, I have a really interesting lens in the sense that I live in a city that was a sanctuary city for Haitians going back to 1986. My father's Dominican, my mother's Puerto Rican. The lens in which I view this is a lens where, you know, I believe that we have the greatest democracy in the world. And so I have the opportunity, and the young people that I work with have an opportunity to shape what happens in the Dominican Republic and shape what happens in America and shape what happens in the world. We can't have double standards.
Dennis Benzin is the vice mayor of Cambridge, Massachusetts. Thank you very much for your thoughts. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Marco. Appreciate it.
I'm sure many convicts wish breaking out of jail were as simple as it seemed to be for El Chapo a couple of weeks ago. You've heard the story, perhaps. One minute, Mexican drug lord Joaquin El Chapo Guzman casually enters a shower area in his cell. That's on video. Then, out of camera range, he slips into a tunnel opening dug right beneath the shower floor. Not on video, but shockingly easy. The thing is, it wasn't really that hard to predict, because over the years, El Chapo's Sinaloa drug cartel has perfected digging this kind of tunnel. And we're not talking digging with trowels here. These are super tunnels, as Monty Real writes in The New Yorker.
Well, most of them are used for smuggling, and they're built
under the border between Mexico and the U.S. And the agents who look into these tunnels and who investigate them came up with the word super tunnels, basically to distinguish them from other tunnels that they call gopher holes, which are basically just pretty primitive holes in the ground that you would crawl through under the border. Super tunnels, they require a lot of engineering. They're usually between 30 and 70 feet below ground. Most of them have electric lighting, they have ventilation, and they also have rails that are laid across the floor where usually electric rail carts can be pushed through. And those rail carts are used both to bring dirt back out of the tunnel while it's being built, and then when it's done, to ship drugs through efficiently.
Yeah, so sophisticated drug infrastructure. What did you find out about the way they are built and who exactly is building them?
Well, there's different levels to sort of the tunneling operation that the Sinaloa cartel has. This is the cartel that Chapo Guzman is the head of course. And basically, they have a group of managers, sort of the higher ups in the cartel who are in charge of tunnels. And they arrange with traffickers to get the drugs to the tunnels. And they also arrange with builders, engineers, and architects who design the tunnels. And at, sort of at the bottom of that chain are the laborers. And these are workers. In some cases, we know that they have been just recruited off the streets. For example, in Tijuana, people with the cartel have gone out and offered temporary jobs to generally sort of poor laborers looking for day jobs.
Yeah, you tell the story of a guy named Fernando. Is that how he was forced into working on these tunnels?
Yeah, in his case, he went to a strip mall in Tijuana and was applying for a job. And while he was filling out the job application, a man approached him and said, "If you're looking for work, I have a job for you cleaning a convenience store." And a couple weeks passed, he called the number that the man had left with him and arranged to go see the convenience store. But when he got there, he was basically taken into the warehouse, the door locked behind him, and he couldn't leave for 2 months. There were 17 men who were arrested when that tunnel was busted, and they each told a very similar story, that they had been lured to that the warehouse by people promising work and then were forced to stay there.
Can we assume that really high people in the drug cartels are ordering these tunnels to get built?
Yeah, I think so. There is a current case that's pending right now, an extradition case. The U.S. is trying to extradite a man named Jose Sanchez Villalobos. And U.S. investigators had been looking into him for several years, and they had identified him as sort of the manager who was in charge of the West Coast super tunnels for the Sinaloa cartel. And they sort of pieced together the structure that he was sort of at the top giving orders to people below him about the construction, about the delivery dates of drugs, how they would be shipped from the U.S. side.
What is the problem for authorities in prosecuting anybody associated with these tunnels? Is it because the tunnels are underground and out of sight?
Yeah, it's very hard to sort of tap into that network and figure out what's going on until the tunnels are actually busted. And when they're busted, it's very rare to have someone in the tunnel at the time. The people who are managing them are insulated. They don't go near them in general. The arrests that are made when a tunnel is busted, they're usually truck drivers who are carrying drugs from the site or managers of the warehouses who also don't have much to do with the construction.
Monty, are you able to explain, like with the escape of El Chapo Guzman, how the tunnels get dug with outlets directly to, in El Chapo's case, directly below the shower area where the escape was planned? Are these guys using GPS? Are they using some kind of X-ray? How do they know what is where?
So the people that I've talked to on how they build these believe that they use azimuths and laser pointers, and the laser pointers will keep the diggers on track. And obviously there need to be calculations before that to know where exactly they're going. In the case of the prison, I can't really say. I know that there's been a lot of talk that he probably had blueprints of the prison and, you know, some help from the inside. But for me to say that, it's speculating.
Writer Monty Real with The New Yorker, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
You are with The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. President Obama's visit to Ethiopia this week has produced a flurry of media coverage about this country in the Horn of Africa. A lot of the media focused on a lack of democracy there. We'll hear more on that in a moment, but did you know this about Ethiopia?
There's the mystique of the Queen of Sheba. There's the belief that the Ark of the Covenant ended up there. They still have it in the church.
That's Abraham Verghese, a physician and the author of the novel Cutting for Stone. Verghese was born in Ethiopia and grew up near the capital, Addis Ababa. He was a medical student there when Emperor Haile Selassie was ousted in a coup in 1974. Verghese says there's much that sets Ethiopia apart from its neighbors.
The capital is at high altitude. The people are predominantly Christian, surrounded by Muslim nations. There's an old monarchy that goes back a long, long way. And it's a very different culture, I think, than many other African nations.
So this is the first time an American president goes to your country, a place where a lot has changed since you were a young man. But I gather Haile Selassie's totemic lions still roam their cages near the presidential palace, huh?
There was a pomp and ceremony associated with the emperor that was really quite incredible. A palace that looks like Buckingham Palace.
What do you think and feel now as you watch President Obama's trip to this country where you grew up?
Well, I'm hoping that it begins a new era in our relations with Ethiopia. America's had a long interest and presence in Ethiopia. We had a very major base in a place called Kano with lots of American servicemen. And then when the Derg came, a very totalitarian military government, America was displaced by Russia and Cuba. The previous prime minister, Meles Zenawi, was actually my classmate in medical school. Clearly, our paths departed. I came here during that overthrow and made a new life while he fought for 20 years as a guerrilla and basically took the country on the course it's on right now.
Yeah, in the wake of Meles Zenawi, though, democracy hasn't exactly thrived in Ethiopia. The parliamentary elections in May, 100% of the seats went to the governing party. Are you glad President Obama is going there? And what can he do to make Ethiopians think differently about democracy?
He's an enormously popular figure, and I can't imagine that his charisma, his charm, won't work some magic and soften the hearts of people who feel that it has to go a certain way.
Charisma can make a difference in democracy in Ethiopia, you think?
I'm not sure that charisma, but there's an earnestness about him. There's a connection to Africa, which I think has great appeal, and people lose sight of quite how he's perceived elsewhere. It's a bit sometimes naive to imagine that our kind of democracy, which, by the way, if you look at the way our Senate and our Congress operates, is not exactly a shining beacon to civil discourse and so on. But nevertheless, I think that the idea that we can just transplant that to any country is sometimes a bit short-sighted because there are deep, deep ethnic divides, including different languages, Sometimes I think we have notions that are just altogether too simplistic about what might work there, which is not to say one should foster autocracy or that sort of thing, but it doesn't always work the way we would imagine.
So, Abraham Verghese, if you could take President Obama to some place or some experience that you lived through when you were a young man in Ethiopia, what would you want him to see?
The people really suffered during this whole, long period of a Stalin-like rule. And when I went there the last time, I was sort of sad to see that some of that joy, some of that innate enthusiasm for life was sort of battered by the long years of service. And yet the smile on the faces of those children are just amazing. And I hope he'll take a walk through some of the impoverished slums, and I hope he'll feel that just natural love and joy that bubbles up in that sort of community. And I think he will. I think he'll see that.
Abraham Verghese is a physician. He's also the author of the novel Cutting for Stone. Been speaking with me from Palo Alto, California. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Pleasure to talk to you.
Finally today, a British horror story that Hitchcock would greenlight. You're relaxing by the British seaside, right? Enjoying the breeze. And unbeknownst to you, a danger lurks in the sky above. It's not a drone. I'm talking rogue seagulls. No joke. The press in Britain is full of stories right now on the escalating threat presented by marauding gangs of gulls. Even the Prime Minister is calling for a national conversation to solve the problem. The World's Man in London, Leo Hornack, says it's all kind of surreal.
You would think we're in a war.
I mean, I'll just give you a sample. This is from the Daily Mail. Packs of birds target women as they develop new tactics to steal your lunch. Gull gangs learn new tricks to steal your seafront snacks. That's the Sunday Times. And then call for action as school children attacked by gulls. And then, as there always is, there's the backlash.
Of course.
So we have from The Guardian, seagulls are not terrorists. This war is a bad idea. So it's getting very, very heated.
So take us behind those headlines. What kinds of attacks have been reported? What do we know for sure?
There's a comic side to this, but actually there have been some genuine attacks. People's pets have been killed by seagulls. They can be dangerous. One woman has hospital treatment after a seagull swooped. And there has been an increase in the number of seagulls in these sort of seaside areas, particularly places where holidaymakers are going, getting fish and chips or ice cream, walking around with them. These are scavenging animals and they see an opportunity and sometimes they take it.
So what did the zoologists have to say? Is there actually a problem here or is this just a media storm in slow summer months?
Well, I spoke to Stephen Moss. He's a very well-regarded naturalist here in the UK. And he said that actually there is an element of maybe we could even say justice in this, interspecies justice. Seagulls, and particularly the herring gull, which has been involved in most of these reports, used to feed off fish in the sea. But because of overfishing, they've been forced inland. And we've created habitats for them by having landfills filled with rubbish and throwing away food. So they have actually come in and they've adapted to our environment because we have taken away the environment that they evolved for. Here's what Stephen Moss told me about the intelligence of herring gulls.
They're amongst the most intelligent living creatures on Earth. And it shows a lot about our rather warped relationship with nature, that as soon as a bird takes advantage of us, and frankly, acts a little bit the way we do, it's clever, it's adaptable, it's a little bit of a ducker and diver, it manages to change its behaviour, something that has helped us as human beings over millennia, we don't like it.
So, Leo, it used to be herring for these birds. Now are Brits going to have to be hereafter totally vigilant about, I don't know, their salmon and egg sandwich on the beach?
Well, I mean, I was actually at the seaside last week. I was sitting on the beach in Wales, and I didn't really realise at that time just how much danger I was potentially in, if you believe the tabloids. I was eating an ice cream and I was eating chips and all this sort of traditional British foods in the rain, of course. But, you know, having read all these headlines and understood, as you heard, the intelligence of these beasts, perhaps next time I'm going to be a bit more careful.
Yeah, well, you survived and you made it to work on Monday. What can I say? The World's Man in London, Leo Hornack, thank you.
Thanks very much, Marco.
Yeah, well, I just got back from some time at the beach, and my safety advice on gulls, just step away from the French fries. You'll be cool. That's all from us today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI and WGBH, supported by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues. The PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors include the Rose Family Fund, by the United States Japan Foundation, the Skoll Foundation, supporting innovative solutions to the world's most pressing problems with the Skoll Award for Social Entrepreneurship at skoll.org, by the PRI Ambassador Council, including Catherine Harris and the Hegart Foundation, John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, and Michael V. and Anne Cerisi, and by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, gatesfoundation.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.